He's arguing that as firms become bigger and bigger, as this entrepreneurial capitalism keeps inventing and we get larger and larger firms, we get into a more bureaucratic world. And what begins to happen in that world? Well, in that world, capitalism doesn't seem so respectable anymore. We begin to say, well, you own share in that stock, but it's not like it's your company. It's not like you started it. It's not like you're willing to die on the steps, if need be, to protect it. And so entrepreneurs become less and less important. Earning income and holding property become values that it's harder and harder to defend. He says, why should the capitalist order need any protection? Does not our own previous argument about growth show that capitalism has plenty of good utilitarian credentials to present? Cannot a perfectly good case be made out for it? He says, probably not. The problem is the gains of capitalism are these slow, slow 2% a year gains. Rational recognition of the economic performance of capitalism and of the hopes it holds out for the future would require almost an impossible moral feat by the have-nots. That performance of capitalism stands out only if we take a long-run view. Any pro-capitalist argument must rest on long-run considerations. In the short run, it is profits and inefficiency that dominate the picture. In order to identify himself with the capitalist system, the unemployed of today would have completely to forget his personal fate, and the politician of today his personal ambition. For the masses, it is the short-run view that counts. Like Louis XV, they feel, after us, the deluge. And from the standpoint of individual utilitarianism, they are, of course, perfectly rational if they feel like that. So he argues that individual masses are going to want to take over things. They're not going to care that in 50 years we can double the standard of living. They're not going to care about supporting entrepreneurs. They're not going to care about long-term investment. They care about taking over, seizing things, and doing that now. Now, as that happens, and you combine this with the daily troubles of every system, you can see that the political force of entrepreneurs is getting weaker. And yet another character now enters the scene, the intellectual complainer. As society gets richer and richer, education is expanding, and the number of what, with some sarcasm, Schumpeter calls intellectuals begins to grow. Now, who are these people, these intellectuals? These are people who have gone through colleges and universities, and they believe that they are really the smartest people. But they go out there and they find that they can't get a job, and they don't actually have any skills. And they get discontented with their lives. They begin to feel like life is unfair to them, because after all, they're the educated ones, they should have good jobs. And they begin to get resentful, and they say capitalism must be at fault. Under a just system, smart people, like me, would be in control, and I could run things. And this intellectual class becomes more and more and more powerful. I sort of imagine these people among kind of angry lawyers, or sanctimonious government bureaucrats, or sort of big organizations sometimes like university faculties, or psychological counselors, people who say, oh, this is so unfair, because my own brilliance is not being recognized. Those people believe that it would be right to overturn capitalism, this world of factories and stuff like that, in favor of an order where they would be in control and they would be ahead of things. And they will be the ones who lead the movement towards socialism. They will be the ones who push it through politically. So, can capitalism survive? Schumpeter says no. He then begins book three of the book, and you have a sense of his style now, opening lines. Can socialism work? Of course it can't. And then he goes on to discuss why, in his view, socialism can work. Basically, he runs through the whole socialist calculation debate that you already are familiar with from the previous lecture. Baron, Mies, Lange, all those folks. And he basically reaches the conclusion, which was common in the 1930s and 40s, that Lange has won the debate, that it is possible to plan the economy. And he believes the intellectual classes will want to plan the economy, even though it's not necessarily a good thing in the long run. And so they will take it over, and that's the way things are headed, for better or for worse. And he thinks it's for worse. I mean, he doesn't think this is a good thing. He's not a fan of socialism. He simply believes this is the dynamic, and it's inevitable. That's what we're doomed to do. Now, it's a little bit hard, I think, to hear his argument clearly at the end of the 20th century, because we have a tendency, when someone says, you know, we're headed towards socialism, to sort of feel like, well, what does that really mean? You know, is he talking Soviet communism? What is he talking about? And I think that in the pure sense that Schumpeter is describing it, it is at least possible to argue that he was right, and that we have entered socialism in something of the sense that he talked about it. After all, if you go back to the early part of the 20th century, like say the 1920s, the federal budget was about 3% of the overall economy. For the last 20 or 30 years, the federal budget has been more than 20% of the whole economy, multiplied by a factor of more than 6. We have programs like Social Security, Medicare and Medicaid, welfare payments. We regulate health and zoning and work hours and minimum wages and unions. And we have environmental laws and rules about discrimination and notification of layoffs and special bank accounts to encourage savings and development assistance to certain communities. All sorts of things like that. You know, in the 1920s, they would have called that socialism. There's no question they would have called it socialism. They would have said the government is controlling a massive part of the economy. Now, the change from the 1920s to the present really is a real and dramatic change. And Schumpeter is writing in the 1940s, right in the middle of when that's happening. Now, we can quarrel back and forth. Is this socialism with a capital S? Is it socialism with a little s? Is it not really socialism, but just enlightened capitalism? I don't know that it's worth arguing about the terminology, but his argument about how we have become much less willing to accept unfettered capitalism and how our educated classes and our intellectuals have pushed for all of these kinds of laws strikes me as deeply true. Schumpeter, even in the 1940s, draws up long lists of things that everyone basically agrees government should do then. He says, the best method of satisfying ourselves as to how far this process of disintegration of capitalist society has gone is to observe the extent to which its implications are taken for granted, both by the business class and by the large number of economists who feel themselves to be opposed 100% to socialism and are in the habit of denying the existence of any tendency toward it. They may pretend that you're opposed to socialism, but when it comes down to conversation, you accept various stabilization policies to prevent recessions or depressions, the desirability of greater equality of incomes, a rich assortment of regulatory measures and antitrust, public control over the labor market and the money market, and so on and so on and so on. And so when you think about Schumpeter's view, I think, you know, you shouldn't be too quick to say, well, I'm not a socialist. I don't believe in any of that. From the point of view of the 1920s, almost everyone in modern America is a socialist, truth be told. Let me talk about a couple of other issues. On the issue of socialism, you remember that his reason for socialism collapsing was really as much political as economic. It was how capitalism would create a political class of people that would want it to collapse the capitalist structure. As we become a wealthier society, I believe it's harder and harder for us to think about what it would mean to be poor, what it would mean to lose what we've built up, what it would mean to lose our houses or our jobs or our clothing or our cars. And so in all those ways, we begin to build up institutions. You see this in the news all the time. Every time, say, farm prices go up and down or gasoline prices go up and down, people don't say, well, that's the market. They say, the government needs to do something about that. We have this problem. We need to fix it. And that sense that we really can't stand the pain of capitalism seems to me something that's been happening more and more and more and more. And I think that that sense of government growing, government becoming more sizable is a powerful commentary on the end of the 20th century. In a funny way, you might say that Schumpeter, writing in the 1940s, anticipated many of our questions toward the end of the 20th century over what risks should people take in a capitalist world. Should you lose your health insurance? Should you lose your car insurance? What risks should people have to absorb, and which ones should society absorb for them?